Enough.
Okay. This on tape. Okay, so now we've got the recording going. And to that end of how I actually teach writing is that I normally do it by passing out a number of different articles for you guys to read, which I could do had I really prepared it. And I have them in my office, and they're sitting in my office, the ones that I like to use, which does me no good here. I also have a bunch of student articles. And what I normally do is pass around two articles that are peer-reviewed journal articles for you to read, and then have you sort of use the rubric that is the rubric designed that I use to grade the formal reports. Have you use that rubric to assess those peer-reviewed journal articles. And then I pass around a student paper that was a good student paper, that's like a BA student paper, and have you use the same rubric to evaluate that student paper. And in going through and evaluating three different papers, we take all of the scores that everybody gets from the rubric and we put them up and we look to see how cohesive they are. And I put up my scores too. And what we find is that people by and large know how to use the rubric and see how to use it and score things pretty consistently. And that the rubric works out pretty well that way. So I don't have the papers that I want in order to do that, but what I can do right now is to start by showing you guys the different resources that are out there and talking about the papers, and then talking about what it is that I'm actually looking for in terms of the different sections, what each section of the paper is supposed to do, and how this is different from what you may have done in Chem 1B, because I know that you wrote a number of formal reports and that Albi does a pretty good job of writing within Chem 1B. And I'm sure Peter is an outstanding writer. Peter is one of the best writers I've ever seen. So from a science background, he's phenomenal. So if you happen to have had Peter, then you had some excellent feedback in terms of writing. And Sarah, I know you might be the only one that had Peter. I don't know if anybody else did, but Peter's fantastic. So he's kind of an old school writer, which those guys are the best. Okay. So let me do some screen sharing and maybe a little less writing than I normally do on my screen and see. I'm just trying to figure out if I want to do it from the computer or if I want to do it from the iPad. What's easier? I have the cursor on the computer. Let's maybe do it that way. I did not practice this, so this is going to be interesting. Stop that share and screen share. Basic primary desktop. Okay. So I've got you guys up on a different screen now. I can still see everybody. Camera's working. You should be able to see I'm on our Chem 12 AL page. I'm going to back up for a minute. And what I want to focus in are the laboratory resources that I have over here. And one of the first things that I've got up is formal report guidelines. And I sort of start in this place and then I'll move to the formal report rubric and we'll take a look at the rubric and kind of what's engaged there. But one of the first things that you do when you're writing a peer-reviewed journal article is that you always go to the instructions for authors. And I should really change that formal report guidelines to instructions for authors. It doesn't matter which journal you're going to. Every single journal has an instructions for authors page because every single journal has their own differences in how they want the manuscript submitted to the journal. They have requirements based on the size of the page, the margins on the page, how you break down each section, what's to be included in each section, the typeface that you use, the font that you use, how they want their references placed into that. The size of the actual images that you're going to use. Not only the size of the image, but where the caption for the image is going to go, whether it's going to go above or below, what point size that caption is supposed to be in, what size the actual structures are supposed to be in the drawing so that there are bond lengths and angles and the size of the actual image that you're drawing. All of those things are outlined within the instructions to authors. And they generally have templates that you can download and just work directly from the template. So while they have all those instructions within the drawing programs, those instructions frequently do come with templates so you can just start writing and not have to think a terrible amount in terms of what you're doing. But these instructions that I've got here were instructions that that Christy Vogel and I put together before Christy retired. And so they were set to be a set of instructions for both Chem 1A, not 1A, mostly Chem 1B, because they don't do a lot of formal reports in Chem 1A, but mostly Chem 1B and Chem 12. And we tried to sit down and look at what was in common between those. And then we allowed, you know, the deviation between Christy and I in what it was that we actually wanted in the discussion sections, the content. But the writing component, we tried to give as good a guidelines as we could. And so I have this in PDF too, if you want to just download it. But the document should be, you know, on 8.5 by 11, margins of 1 inch, 1 inch, 0.5 and 1, left, right, top, bottom, and a 0.5 header and a 0.6 footer. Typeface should be in easily readable fonts, such as 12-point Helvetica, Times New Roman, or Palatino. Don't get too crazy in the font. A lot of people want to start thinking of this as a creative writing assignment, and they always start with the fonts and want to pick something that's going to look really pretty on the page, which just makes it really difficult to read. So stick with a standard, simple, easy font. Double space everything. I should like highlight that. It should be like everything. The only way that we can write feedback to you when you hand in a formal report is if you give us enough space to write that feedback, that it's really hard to cram comments into the margins, and especially when we're trying to show you how to reformat a sentence or something. So even the abstract, just double space everything. And I know that takes up more paper, but it's the only way that we can provide you reasonable feedback is if you give us enough room to be able to do that. So that's the document formatting component. The title. Title is recommended that the title be written after the experiment. It should be brief and grammatically correct, but accurate and complete enough to stand alone. So the title should include keywords that might engage the reader. Avoid phrases such as on the, a study of, report on, use of. The idea there is that those phrases are redundant. We know that we're coming to the table to read a report, that we're reading a study of something or a report on something. So those types of phrases tend to be redundant. And so a study on the synthesis of salicylic acid or acetylsalicylic acid would be better written as just the synthesis of acetylsalicylic acid. It doesn't have to have these other extra components. And try not to be tricky or fancy. Just keep the title simple. The title does not have to be lengthy. It just has to say specifically what the paper is on. The abstract section. The abstract really does two jobs. It tells what was done and what was found. Those are the two main components of what the abstract does, what was done and what was found. Not in a tremendous amount of detail. So here under this, we say the abstract is a complete summary of what was done and what was found. It includes an overview of the general methods and results. It does not include experimental details. It doesn't include concentrations or amounts. It doesn't include temperatures in general. It just does what was done and what was found. And it's written in the past tense as a standalone description of your work. So for instance, in the acetylsalicylic acid lab, we could say something along the lines of acetylsalicylic acid was synthesized from salicylic acid and acetic anhydride. The product produced was isolated in a 91% isolated yield with a melting point of 134 to 135 degrees. The product was characterized by ferric chloride test and FTIR spectroscopy, which indicated that the product was consistent with literature values. Done. And that would be the entire abstract. So it just says what was done and what was found, the main conclusions of the study. That's what the abstract is doing. Stop me at any point if there's any questions. I'm kind of watching the chat and glancing over at my second monitor once in a while. But if you guys have anything that you want to address or ask, make sure that you stop me. Okay, so the introduction. The purpose of the introduction is to stimulate interest for the reader. The idea here is that the introduction should state why your piece is important, what the motivation is. It should go over sort of a history of what's been done in the past, and then end with how your work is going to be different if it is going to be different. So in general, when we do formal reports or when we do a peer-reviewed article, we're going through and we're taking our work that is novel and new, but is always built on somebody else's or many other people's works. And so what we do is we want to highlight those other works and why they're of such great importance, either economically or important environmentally or to people's health, all the different reasons why something might be important. And then we want to show why our work is different, how it's different, and sort of launch into the methods and material section. So what we say here is, what do I got? It should describe the motivation, the focus of the experiment, why it's significant. It may contain theoretical background, chemical names, formulas, equations, structures. All information in this section should include references to the literature where the material was found. Wikipedia is not the best source of information. However, I've kind of opened that up in recent years because it's really hard for you guys to find scientific literature. And this is one thing that, I have the ability now to do some cool things. Okay, so we'll do some literature searches and talk about literature searches today too. That's maybe one thing that I can contribute electronically, and we can spend some time doing this. It's really cool. Usually what I say is Wikipedia is not the best source of information. And so I kind of discourage you from going to Wikipedia, especially for making that your sole source of information. Wikipedia has turned out to be pretty good. It has its own sources in it. And if you're looking for sources, going to Wikipedia and then using Wikipedia sources as your primary sources is a better way to go. You can actually go to the source list on Wikipedia, click on the links that are at the bottom of the Wikipedia page, and use those for some of your literature sources. Some of those you'll be able to access, some of those will be closed and you won't be able to access them. And that's our main problem, is that anytime we go to the literature and we want to review the literature, most of that is proprietary. Most of the literature is behind firewalls where you guys can't access it. And it would be wonderful if our library had different resources for us to be able to go and use. But the chemical literature is unique in that it's extremely expensive and specific to our area of study. And so while four-year universities have huge numbers of resources, you can go up to UCSC and you could use the library at UCSC, and they have many different resource tools for you to be able to look at the primary literature and to find significant references for your papers. In order for Cabrillo to have the same references, I've talked to the librarians at UCSC, and our main librarian used to work for the UC system and understands what those costs are. And he told me flat out, he said, if we wanted to get what they have at UCSC, it would take the entire, I think he said 10 times the library budget that they have for the year just for chemistry. It was just an amazing amount of money that it would cost in order to provide you guys with those types of resources. And so I've tried to make some deals with UCSC in order to get access just for the instructors at Cabrillo. They were unwilling to do that. So I went all kinds of routes just trying to get access for myself, which, because of special projects, we really need it. For special projects, we need to be able to read the primary literature, and special projects are all based on the primary literature, and having you guys pull papers down and trying to reproduce that work. And if you don't have access to that literature, then we can't really do special projects. And I frequently, always actually send you guys in small groups up to UCSC to go and use their library resources, because they're freely available to the community. You can walk into the UCSC library and you can use their computer system and log on and do all of the searches, download all the literature, put in a drive into the computer, download all the papers, and walk out with them for free of charge. And if you need help from the librarian, you can ask them for help, and they don't ask you to see a UCSC library card. They're a librarian, you're a student, and they're there to help you, and they will sit down at the computer with you and show you how to use the different resources and do that. So that's something to keep in mind, that UCSC, well, when it's open and not under pandemic, is freely available to you guys, and the library resources that are freely available. Right now, I have access to those library resources because I'm also a research associate at UCSC. So I have access to all the UCSC materials as well. And that's what I think that maybe we could do a little bit of today. I can actually pull down some papers, and I had forgotten I actually had that access. So the introduction, try to stay away from Wikipedia as much as you can. If you need to use Wikipedia and that's the only source of information you're coming up with, then by all means, look at Wikipedia and see what they've got to say as well. This section contains a minimum of 2 paragraphs, which means that it can be more lengthy than that. But the first paragraph is really, or the first series of paragraphs, is the overview of what was done and then why it was important. The overview of what was done previously by other groups, why it was important. And then the last paragraph is what I think of as a non-technical overview. And that's really where your experiment differs from what has been done in the past. It's where you give an overview of what it was that your study did differently. Now, we are doing labs that are out of Pavia. We're not doing anything different, but we can still write a non-technical overview, because what we can do is we can take within the introduction and we can write about acetyl salicylic acid and when it was first synthesized, how it was synthesized, the chemical importance of acetyl salicylic acid. There's a number of different things that we can talk about. And then we can go into the non-technical overview that describes exactly how we're going to synthesize it. And so our non-technical overview would say something along the lines of acetyl salicylic acid was synthesized from salicylic acid, acetic anhydride, and an acid catalyst. Still, within the non-technical overview, we don't get too detailed. We want to add some details, but we don't want to give everything away in there. So it's not meant to be that you can reproduce the experiment from this non-technical overview. So acetyl salicylic acid was produced from acetic acid, acetic anhydride, and an acid catalyst. The product was simply crystallized, filtered, and then analyzed through or characterized through melting point determination, ferric chloride test for phenolic character, and FTIR analysis. And that's it. So you're not giving results. You're just sort of giving a non-technical overview of what is about to be presented. It's a transition from the introduction into your methods and materials and discussion section. That's really what that last paragraph is. So you need to think about transitions from one paragraph to another. That's kind of how that non-technical overview or what that non-technical overview job is doing. And then methods and materials can go in a number of different places. Some people like to put the methods and materials right up after the introduction. Some people like to put the methods and materials after the discussion section, and it depends on each journal. I always just put them right after the introduction. And here I give a couple of examples of methods and materials and what that writing looks like. So in the methods and materials, all reagents should be listed and sources cited. Those are the sources where the material was obtained. That's very common practice, so that if somebody wants to reproduce your work, they want to reproduce it exactly. They don't want to buy chemicals from another source that may have different types of contaminants in them or may have a different purity than what was actually used in the experiment itself. And so it's very common for researchers to list the chemicals, where they were purchased, and if the chemical was modified prior to use, how it was modified, such as if it was double distilled or if it was recrystallized a number of times before use and then it's purity checked. Anything that you might have done to clean up a chemical, they want to know that as well. And for us, you guys are getting your chemicals just out of the chemical stockroom. So we can say that they were obtained from the Cabrillo College chemical stockroom without modification. That's sort of the catch line. We'll see that down here too. The make and model of instrumentation used for characterization should be reported here. This includes software for analysis. So the melting point determination devices, those melt temps, you would want to know the make and model of the melt temp, the make and model of the digital thermometer, the make and model of the FTIR instrument that we're using, the make and model of the software that we're using to analyze that. All of those things should be reported in the methods of material section. The procedure for the experiment is given in condensed format. We'll talk about what that condensed format looks like. I have it down here. And if the procedure was followed unmodified in your reports, because you're reproducing something from a literature source such as Pavia, you may simply cite the lab manual specifying sections that were performed without modification. For instance, the procedure in Pavia et al. Reference number was followed without modification. So that just means you did exactly what was supposed to happen in Pavia. However, if you modify things, and we talked about several modifications that we did in the acetyl salicylic acid lab. For instance, we ditched the sand bath idea. We modified the way that we were measuring some of our quantities. I don't think we changed the heat or any of the other analysis. Those were the only main things that we changed. But you want to make sure that you highlight any modifications that were done from the procedure itself. Experiments that are designed by an individual student must be described in separate paragraphs, so they should be clearly described out entirely. Okay, and then down here, I also list some of your equipment. For instance, your melt temps are melt temp 2 by Barnstead Thermaldyne, their model 1001 with a Fluke 51 KJ digital thermometer. And the IR instrument is a Nicollet Avatar 360 with Omnigate software by Thermo Fisher. So I've got right in there, highlighted out what our equipment is so that you don't even have to go looking for it. But in general, it's a good idea just within your laboratory notebooks, whenever you go to use a piece of instrumentation that you haven't used before, to write down in the experiment, in your laboratory notebook, what the instrument is that you're using and what the software is, so that you have all that detail. And when you go back to actually write your report, you're not missing it, that you know where everything is. Okay. So an example of what this should look like. These were things that we don't have in our labs, but they're an example of something that I just grabbed from my dissertation. The second one here is actually a procedure that we do second semester. And I've condensed it down to try to show how we would write in a more condensed format, separate from what Pavia is. So I'm not looking for you to copy the instructions in Pavia. I'm looking for you to take what is in Pavia and to write it in a more condensed format. That's a good skill to have. So the first paragraph is telling me materials and equipment. The second paragraph is telling me about the procedure that was followed. So bromobenzene, magnesium turnings, anhydrous diethyl ether, 6 molar hydrochloric acid, and petroleum ether were obtained from the chemistry stockroom and used without modification. So there's all my chemicals that I'm using. Melting points were determined using a Barnstead Thermaline Melt Temp 2 model 1001 equipped with a Fluke 51 KJ digital thermometer. Infrared spectra were obtained on a Perkin-Elmer 1600 series. And I know that that 1600 is different than what is up above. The reason is the old paragraph here was for our old instrumentation. And then I've since updated it to reflect the new software and the new instrument that we have. FTIR, okay, let's see, HNMR. So I threw HNMR in here just to show you kind of how we would write it out. HNMR and carbon NMR were obtained on a Bruker AC250, 250 megahertz NMR equipped with a quad nucleus probe, and in some cases on a Varian Unity 500 NMR. Chemical shifts are reported relative to tetramethylsilane in parts per million. Anyway, I'm not going to read this whole thing because the rest of it just goes into some boron NMR and just different ways that I would indicate different types of instrumentations. Should I be using those types of instrumentations? What's more important, I think, really, is this next paragraph that gets into how we take a procedure that is a very lengthy procedure and turn it into a more condensed format. Never start a sentence with a number. So instead of 15 milligrams and writing out the number 15, every time you want to start a sentence with a number, it should be written out in words, just a standard sort of English formatting. 15 milligrams, or find a way to turn it around and put the 15 milligrams in the quotes over here. You could say magnesium turnings, and then you could put in quotes 15 milligrams, 6.45 millimoles. You could do it that way. This is just the way I chose to do it. 15 milligrams of magnesium turnings were placed into a 20 mil round bottom flask. The flask was fitted with a magnetic stir bar, a Claisen head with rubber septa, and a drying tube. A solution of bromobenzene, here's an instance of that, 1.01 grams, 6.43 millimoles in anhydrous diethyl ether, 4 milliliters, was added to the stirred reaction flask via syringe dropwise. Addition of bromobenzene diethyl ether solution was maintained at a rate to produce a steady reflux of the reaction mixture, which means that the reaction mixture was kind of steadily boiling, but not freaking out. So reflux means something that is boiling, condensing on the glassware, and falling back in. And you generally see this sort of wavy, really cool, when you look through the reflux condenser, you can see this area where liquid is forming. And it's gas that's coming up and condensing out into a liquid, and it makes this sort of shimmery, almost liquid waterfall looking like in a very narrow area, and then it disappears down below. That's what we call the reflux. And the reflux is the point at which gas and liquid coexist at the same time. And so that's what we call a reflux. After addition of bromobenzene diethyl ether solution, the reaction was allowed to cool to room temperature. A solution of bromobenzene, the amounts are there, in anhydrous diethyl ether, 2 mils, was added rapidly via syringe. The reaction was allowed to stir for 20 minutes. The reaction mixture was quenched, quenched meaning the reaction was stopped, that's what quenched means, with hydrochloric acid, 6 milliliters. The resulting biphasic system was separated using a separatory funnel and the aqueous phase extracted with 10 milliliters diethyl ether. The ether layers were combined and evaporated in a rotary evaporator, so we just use that word evaporated, could mean a number of different ways, to yield a yellow solid oil mix. The solid was triturated, I have to explain that word later, triturated with petroleum ether and filtered to yield the crude triphenyl methanol as a white powder. The crude material was recrystallized from isopropanol to afford the pure triphenyl methanol, and then I report the characterization. So the characterization is always the last line. It gives the yield in grams, millimoles, and percent. So I have three different ways of reporting the yield that I got there: grams, millimoles, and percent. The melting point, which is the range, the FTIR, how it was performed, whether it was a liquid or solid, in this case a solid KBR pellet, reported in reciprocal centimeters. And then these numbers would be the important wavelengths for characterization, such as if I had an alcohol peak, I'd make sure I want to list it. If I have a carbonyl peak, I want to make sure that I list it. The other peaks that are significant wavelengths that are in the fingerprint range, I may choose to list some of those significant wavelengths, but I'm not listing everything. I'm being selective. Maybe as many as 10 wavelengths. I don't think I would do more than 10. But you sort of pick out your maximum wavelengths, ones that are giving you your lowest percent transmission. Those are the tallest peaks. Those are the ones that I would highlight and report there just to give characterization. And if some of them were really important, like alcohol or carbon-oxygen single bond or carbonyl, I want to make sure that those were represented in there. And you don't list them and say what they are to. You're just listing them so that somebody could take the IR that they obtained, look back at the data, and see if they have those represented peaks. Okay, I'm stalling for a second because I'm thinking about how I want to rephrase this. There are many, many parts of a formal report which are entirely redundant. For instance, why do I need to list out all of this information here when I'm going to put it into the discussion section. And not only that, within the discussion section, I'm actually going to show the actual IR that I got so that they can actually see the IR. So why am I listing it here in terms of listing these wavelengths and putting in all this information if this is completely redundant and I'm going to do it again and show the actual IR and somebody can just go and look at the IR? And the answer is that in a formal report, in a communication like this, the communication is used by readers in many different ways. When I sit down to read an article, I never just read the article straight on through. And I do this today as I'm going through and I'm reading coronavirus articles and I'm reading them constantly in the peer-reviewed literature. I read these biochemistry and medical journals exactly the same way that I read a chemistry journal. I read the abstract first. And after I read the abstract, I decide whether it's something that I'm really interested or not. Actually, the title is what usually grabs me. I go from the title and I read the abstract. After I read the abstract, I scan the paper. I kind of look at their charts and graphs to see what's there. But the first thing that I go for after all of that is the conclusion. I go and I find their conclusion. And after I read the abstract, I read their conclusion. And the reason is I don't want to spend my time reading this entire journal article if it's not of interest and isn't going to tell me something critical that I want to learn. And so I read the abstract first because it tells me what was done and what was found. And I read the conclusion because the conclusion is a restatement of the abstract that goes into a little bit more detail. So the conclusion helps me to decide whether or not I want to invest the rest of my time and read the rest of this paper. Then I jump sort of to their methods and materials section to look and see how do they actually do the study? And is this a study that is actually valid, or are they wasting my time because this study isn't really done in the way that is making it credible? And then after I read that, then I start going back and reading their discussion section and their and reading everything that they have to say. In a chemical journal, I would wait and go back and read the methods and materials a little bit later when I'm actually looking or thinking about reproducing this. Or if I want to see, after I've read it in a chemical sense, is this something I'm really interested in? I may just jump right into their methods and materials section and read that to see if I can glean what is it that they're doing that's unique, that's different, or a technique that I could use or implement within my own studies. And so, so different pieces of information show up in different places because of the way people jump all around when they read these things. And if I'm going to actually, I see their question, hang on a second. If I'm actually going to reproduce the work like we do in special studies in second semester, then we rely really heavily on these methods and material sections because this is what we're actually reproducing. And when we go into the IR room and we have our product and we want to compare it, these numbers are a really easy thing to compare to without having to go back and dig out the whole literature thing. It's just easy to have these wavelengths to be able to compare your results to really quick. And this is such a condensed thing that it's easy to have on hand rather than having to have 15 different pieces of paper with all these spectra on it. And so pieces of information show up redundantly throughout the report. Okay, Ying, the formal report, which lab are we supposed to do it on? I haven't given you an exercise yet in terms of what to do a formal report on. I wanted to start with some writing exercises, I think, by having you guys write out a discussion section, but mainly on the mechanism of the acetylsalicylic acid reaction. So I don't think I'm going to have you write an entire formal report. I just want you to break down the discussion section, and I'm going to show you exactly what it is I want you to do and how to use language to break that down. So that's the writing exercise that I'm most interested in after we get done with this, and that's what I'm going to assign today. So not an entire formal report, just a discussion section of the mechanism itself and breaking down that mechanism and trying to use the language the way that I did before to talk about what is actually happening in each one of those steps. So a smaller writing exercise, because if you were going to write a formal report, then I need to give you data on which to write that formal report. You need to have a percent yield. You need to have melting points and the IR, and you need to have actually done the experiment so that your individual things that went right and went wrong and all the differences that would have happened in your data could be represented in your writing and in your discussion section. And you would be telling me what you did right, what you did wrong, what you did wrong, and how it all came together. And if I give you data, it just doesn't seem like you could talk about it in a first person sort of way, in an experience way that you did it. You'd be trying to do your best to do that, but there's no substitute for actually having gone through, done an experiment, and being able to correlate your results with what you did in the time that the reaction was going on. And that's really what the formal report was about. So that's my concern in trying to have you write a formal report. I don't want to put you guys on the spot where you're trying to make things up. I want them to be practical skills and to react, actually reflect your knowledge base. And I think that that's one thing that you can do is talk about the reaction mechanism, because we went into great detail about that. And that has value both in the lab and in the lecture class in learning those mechanistic steps. And so that's kind of where I want to go with that. Does that help? Colin's giving me a thumbs up. Seems like that's working for most people. Cool. Okay. Kylie, when are we getting questions for the other labs? You're not getting questions for the other labs, Kylie. Let that go. That is gone. It's history. I don't want to do that. You don't want to do that. You got other things to do. You got other classes that they're piling crap on top of you. You guys are trying to do work. You're trying to like survive. I don't want to be, yeah, I know. Or is giving me a thank you, man. I'll tell you what, I just had a talk with my colleagues. We had a meeting last Thursday and they were all talking about how they were going to do finals and how they were doing tests and how they were doing homework. And both my girls are in college right now, and they're both down in the Santa Cruz area now. And I'm watching both of them struggle, that for whatever reason, instructors think that you guys are working from home and that you need a shit ton to do to keep you occupied. And they don't realize how many people are actually trying to work and do other things and just trying to put food on the table and survive right now. And that by throwing more work at you, they're not helping you. They're just drowning you. And so I'm watching my own girls just struggle under the workload that is killing them. And everything that I can think to ditch, I'm just ditching it. I mean, we still want to get through the learning objectives. So I'm cognizant of that, but I'm also cognizant of not burdening you with what I consider to be busy work if I just create other stuff for you guys to do. So that's kind of where I'm at. All right. We're going to get through this together. That's where we're at. Okay. Enough of me rambling. Let's look at the results section. Unless there's any questions in here in terms of this section. So how will we grading? Oh yeah. So you're worried about grade in lab. You guys already turned. Okay. Yeah. This is a harder thing to do. I have some stuff that I have already looked at. You guys have already turned in some things for lab. And mainly what I do in lab is this anyway, to be absolutely honest with the way that I look at lab. 90% of your grade, yeah, it really is 90%. It's about 90% of your grade of what you do in lab is what I see you do in lab. It is how you work with your hands. It is how cognizant you are of being careful of working with the materials. How well do you pay attention to the instructions? How well do you follow those instructions? How thoughtful are you when accidents happen in terms of cleaning things up? It's all of those things that can't be graded by looking at your writing. It's actually what I see. It's observations from the class. It's as if it's a drama class, right? And so in a drama class, you're evaluating the students based on their performance and how you think they're performing and how they improve after you give them instructions. That's the way that I think about lab. And so part of it is your results. Part of it is what is the percent yield that you got, but not just on one experiment, but if you did a recrystallization and we did it on four different experiments, How did your recrystallizations improve? Or each time you go through and do that recrystallization, do I still have to remind you about all the little tips and tricks in order to get a good number? And are you still getting a bad number at the end of it? Those are things that weigh into it a bit. But like I said, 90% is observations, and 90% for just about everybody, they do extraordinarily well in lab. I have very few people that ever get a C in lab or get a D in lab. They are almost all A's and B's, and by far the majority are A's. B's tend to happen by people not turning in work when they were supposed to turn it in, and turning in incomplete or half-assed work, because 90% is what I'm seeing. And as I go through and I put in those scores each day of what I'm seeing, those scores are so high most of the time for every student that they by and far overwhelm everything else. And so then when there's work that is half-assed and turned in, that knocks down the grade, and you get too many of those, or you miss one or two reports, and that knocks you down into B category. C category is really where people are just giving me their laboratory notebook at the end and haven't turned in sort of any of the reports that I've asked them to turn in. They've gone through and they've done all the work, and they were pretty damn good in lab, but they just decided that for whatever reason it was too overwhelming and couldn't keep up with the smaller reports that I've been asking you guys to do, and they turn in their laboratory notebook at the end, and that's sort of C material. And D material or failing material is where people are just disrupting lab, and generally me having to file disruptive student complaints because of what's going on in lab, and having to pull them out and constantly talk to them and just constantly be on them so they don't hurt other people around them and don't hurt themselves. Those are people who are failing lab. So Katrina, what am I grading? I've already assessed kind of what you guys have done for the most part, and we're just trying to hang in there and do the best we can in lab and get you guys the rest of the skills that I want there to be in place as we move on into next semester. So definitely don't freak out about the writing components and the questions. Now you guys are all awesome in my book. Okay. I hope that helps a little bit. Let's see, what else do I got? Okay. Yeah. Ying, stop freaking out. No freaking out. Okay. Any other questions on this, where we were before? Methods of materials. And I'm sorry. I think my wife just stepped out, which means Finley now is going to be the barking menace. I may have to actually invite him in here so he'll stop barking. Although sometimes that backfires on me. So he might quiet down. Okay. So results. The section in results includes data tables, graphs, sample calculations. Sample calculations was for Chem 1B. Don't add sample calculations into anything for OChem. The sample calculations that you do in your percent yields and other things, I know how you calculate a percent yield. I mean, I can look at your numbers and tell what your percent yield is. I don't need sample calculations in terms of how you're calculating things. So that was much more where you had lengthy sort of computational things for Chem 1B. And you gotta remember that this was put together by Christy and I to go over both Chem 1A and Chem 12, or Chem 1B and Chem 12. All tables and graphs should have appropriate titles. And it says be half page, but not, I don't know that that's necessarily true. They need to be big enough to be viewed easily. And sort of half page in format is what we say, but that's taken with a grain of salt there. The axis of the graphs will be properly labeled, including units. Results should be summarized in text as well as tables. So we're not just throwing tables in there. You're summarizing below each table. You're writing a paragraph that summarizes those results as well. So I know it's redundant, but that's because our data sets are rather small. In a large data set, it's very common to take and to put the table and then also talk about that table and breaking it down to some degree. So that's why that's in there. Okay, discussion and conclusion sections. They're sort of treated as one. The discussion sort of leads into the conclusion. The conclusion is the last paragraph of the discussion section. So I don't normally break it down discussion and then a heading for conclusion separately. I don't normally do that. I just let it all feed into one. You can break them down if you want. For organic papers, the first part of the discussion should be about the reaction mechanism. This is not a hard rule, but if the mechanism is very small, it can be placed into the introduction section. Likewise, if there are topics to discuss that could come before the mechanism, it's fine to do so. But the main part, the meat of the paper, is the discussion of the mechanism itself. And mainly, I want that to be true because I'm really asking you guys to learn the language of describing a reaction mechanism and why the reaction is taking place. That's sort of the learning that I want there. It's not enough to just say that this is a transformation that happens. I want to know how it happens, why it happens. So to do that, the mechanism is broken down into individual steps. Each step should be preceded by a figure and a caption illustrating the step. The text should be then, the text should then explain what is taking place. The figures can be hand-drawn, as can the caption headings. Computer-drawn images are really nice, but take a long time to master. And I go through a number of applications that we could do there. But in general, I remember going through school and writing out my formal reports and spending an enormous amount of time making all the images look perfect. Not drawing them by hand, but trying to learn how to draw them on a computer application. And it took as much time to do all the images as it did to actually do the damn writing. I'm more interested in the writing. And so if it's appropriate for you, save space within your writing for this is where the image is going to go. Hand draw the image. Draw it in pencil if you want. Doesn't have to be pen so that you can erase it if it goes awry. And just leave that space, draw the image by hand, and then continue doing the writing so that you don't need to have computer drawn images. If you want, we can talk about some different applications that will allow you to do some computer drawings, but even ChemDoodle, which is one of the cheaper ones, ChemDoodle now is fairly expensive. I looked at it the other day, and I think ChemDoodle is over $100 now for a student license. It used to be down around 25, and they've upped the price on ChemDoodle. ChemDraw is over $500. So ChemDraw itself, for a student, that's a student license, an educational license, $500. For a business license, it's up in the thousands. It's several thousand dollars for a business license. And that's not a site license. That's a single copy to be used at a business. It's that software is incredibly expensive. So those are not realistic applications for a student to use. There was one, I'm trying to think of, I'll go back and find it. I found one that somebody had, one of my colleagues had noted. It was one of the adjuncts at Cabrillo that found a drawing application that is pretty bare bones, but is completely free. And so there are some of them out there that will allow you to do that. I just don't know what platforms they work on. I don't know how platform independent those free applications are. Anyway, so don't get too caught up in doing that. The writing is more important than the figures. And then let's see, in addition to the mechanisms, the discussion section is generally where the results section is thoroughly integrated to produce sound conclusions. Critical thinking is employed to analyze the results and deduce valid conclusions. This is the part where I was talking about before, where we take each piece of data, and each piece of data needs to be cohesive, saying the same thing. So your melting points should be one paragraph where you talk about the melting points. And whether they're on or not, and if they're not, what may have happened in the experiment that may have led to a lower melting point. Your ferric chloride test, describing the ferric chloride test, what the result was, whether it was consistent with the product that you expected or different, showing that there's some impurity there, that some leftover phenol or starting material that's present. A third paragraph would be the FTIR, the ferric chloride test. The FTIR. And the FTIR, then we're looking at the wavelengths and whether or not they're consistent with the literature values. And we want to describe not only the starting material FTIR, but the product FTIR and how the peaks have moved and shifted. And is there any evidence for any starting material showing up in your product FTIR? And then after you do all of that, then you hit the conclusion, which brings all of those pieces of data together and just is one more restatement saying that the product was consistent with literature values and of high yield, which was great, or the product had some contamination issues and that you had reasons in your experiment why that happened. And yet the product was made, but of a decreased purity in that regard. So you just want to pull all of those pieces together. So many paragraphs describing the mechanism, and then one paragraph for each one of your characterizations, and then a conclusion statement that brings it all together. That's that section. And then I have some helpful things in here in terms of language and formatting. And the language, this is and formatting is a good question. There's a really good reference book. Let me see if I have it up here. Hang on a second. Two really. And I don't think I've talked about these before. Let me go back and stop screen sharing for a second. So if you've got me in speaker view, you can see me in on the big screen now. This is the first book that I really like. This is the ACS style guide. And I don't know if I'm looking at the screen, I'm seeing a picture of myself and it looks like it's in reverse on the camera. The ACS style guide is a fantastic writing resource. And if you're going on in chemistry, or if you're going on in physics, or if you're going on in any of the sciences, really, where you're going to be doing a lot of writing, this book in particular is really helpful on not only how to write up certain pieces of data, and some of them get into very technical physical chemistry types of data, but they tell you how to make a really good scheme, how to draw that scheme, how to language, how to use language to describe the data that you're talking about with great examples. They have how to give references for all the different types of literature that you would reference, periodicals, journal articles, textbooks, just everything, every type of article that you can think of. They have the proper way to reference them and show you how to reference them in here. It's just a tremendous resource for writing. It's a great, great book. And the other one that I haven't used as much, but is also a good book, is called A Short Guide to Writing About Chemistry. And this is more about language usage than it is about actual data. So this talks more about how you structure your arguments and how how to write effectively, good communication. That's what this one is. ACS Style Guide also has that. It's sort of redundant with that. What the ACS Style Guide has that the short course about writing doesn't have is more technical information, which I find, and I've got several bookmarks in this that I go back to over and over again. Every time I want to do a correct citation or I want to do a writing about a piece of analytical instrumentation, I go back to this book and pull that section up and write about it in the correct way. So those are two really phenomenal resources, but they're added expenses. And so I don't make any of these required for the course because our textbook is expensive enough. Okay, let me go back to screen sharing. And we're in here in language and formatting. So in general, the report is written in third person, impersonal observer voice. There are times where you switch out of that third person voice. For instance, there are times when you are comparing your results to a literature result, and the only way you can do that is do that in first person. You can't do it in third person. So if Pavia says that in their experiment in making acetylsalicylic acid, they recover their product in a 97% yield, and you recover yours in a 67% yield. You can't discuss that without doing it in the first person. We found that the yield of acetylsalicylic acid in our hands gave a 67% yield, whereas Pavia et al. Report a 97% yield. You have to switch into the first person in order to be able to do that. And so that's absolutely correct. So when we think about a report being fully in the third person, that's not true. We just try to keep it as much in the third person, impersonal observer voice, as we can. And then when we talk about our own results in comparison to somebody else's, then we can switch into first person. Reports may be typed or handwritten as long as they are legible. So I don't require you to type things. However, almost everybody does type them on the computer and then leaves space for the equations, calculations, structures, and just write those in by hand. And you can write those in pencil such that if you do need to erase after making a mistake, because it's very easy to make mistakes when writing those, you can do so. The figures, charts, and schemes, I sort of used the information that was in that ACS style guide to go through and to outline the correct way to put captions in here. So captions or title is figure one, chart five. Let's see what happened. Here we go. So the captions are in here, and they're followed by a description of the item. The caption is generally 2 points smaller than the body text and indented both left and right such that it fits underneath the image, whatever the image is. Each caption is numbered sequentially within the graphical image type. For instance, you may have figures 1 through 8 and then wish to place two tables, which would be table 1 and table 2, so that your figures are all numerically numbered throughout. And if we start tables, then they start over at table number 1 and they get numbered throughout. And descriptions, a single structure or formula does not need a caption. This is often used when a single molecule is desired to be shown. Figures are single structures, apparatus illustrations, or graphs of reaction data for which the caption is placed below. Single mechanistic steps can be either figures or schemes. However, most journals generally refer to them as figures. Charts are collections of structures for which the caption is placed below. So a chart may be that I am reporting the yields on maybe 15 different products, and I list structurally those 15 different products with their yields and some other information. That would be a chart. A scheme shows action, such as a full reaction mechanism or flowchart for which the caption is placed below. So a scheme is where I have a reaction mechanism from start to finish all the way through. That would be considered to be a scheme. Tables are collections of data or results for which the caption is placed above. So the only one where the caption goes above is a table. Every other type, the caption goes below. And then in references, I have several examples of references. So if you're referencing a book, if you're referencing a journal, if you're referencing a patent or a web page, I have the way that those references should be cited. And you're using and citing them with a superscript. So this could be mid-sentence where you're referencing a piece of information, or it could be referenced at the end of a sentence, using superscripts in order to match those journal references or those books or whatever it is. The first time you use a reference, the numbers should be sequential. So reference number 1, reference number 2, reference number 3. But if I'm gonna go back and reference number 2 again, I can slip it back in and still call it reference number 2 and just reuse it a second time if I'm using that piece of information again. I don't have to create a new reference for it. I can just reuse the old number. And I think, yeah, so what I did here is I had just some links. So each one of these was a link that showed you an example of how I would cite a book, how I would cite a number of articles that are referencing the same thing and piling them all into one. So this is 2A, 2B, 2C, 2D, all piled in there. The third one is a patent. Yeah, so the US patent number is here. And then I have some web pages that I've also highlighted out and showed you how I cited the web pages. So there's examples of all of those different types of citations there. Okay. So all that information is there. And that was all under the formal report guidelines. Then in the rubric, I don't know what's easier to look at, either the PDF or this guy. The rubric I had broken down, and don't get too caught up into where I say how many words something is supposed to be. I think I only did that in the abstract. And I only did that because sometimes people tend to write really long abstracts when an abstract should be fairly short. Excuse me. So I tried to just give a sense of how many words that should be, but that's not an absolute. So mastery, let me just go through the mastery idea here. Abstract should be written in the past tense. Describe the work that was done and the results found without using experimental details. The introduction describes the motivation and the focus of the experiment, contains appropriate theoretical background. The last paragraph is the non-technical overview of the experiment. Methods and materials, the lab manual and other materials are properly cited. Deviations, additions, omissions are clearly expressed in paragraph format. Result data presented in table format and discussed in paragraph format. All data tables, graphs, half page with correct captions. Discussion, conclusion, results analyzed to produce sound conclusions. All experimental difficulties, errors, questions discussed correctly. Last paragraph is conclusion, expressing briefly the bottom line of the experiment. And the language grammar formatting, third person used throughout, well-formed sentence structure, grammatically correct, excellent, consistent formatting. So, and each one of these, and you've seen these rubrics before for me, for technique rubrics and things, each one of these starts to show sort of a breakdown in each category and is not meant to be absolute that you hit all of these errors, but that you're falling into this category because of a number of different errors that are sort of setting you into a particular category. And again, it's a fairly generous rubric such that mastery is 4 points, accomplished is 3.4, adequate is 3, developing 2.6, beginning 0, such that it's very easy to score in the A or B range in this, super easy to score in the C range. It's really hard to get into the beginning and developing range into this rubric. You really got to be messing up to fall into that, because so many of these categories, you're going to knock out mastery in so many of these categories, maybe accomplished in a few, that you're still falling in the A, B category pretty easily. It's not 4 points, 3 points, 2 points, 1 point, 0 point. It's 4, 3.4, 3, which goes along with sort of the 4.0 scale of what an A, a mid B, a mid C sort of is when you average it all out. So that's the way that rubric is set up. Okay, so what I want you guys to do, let me switch from this view. Stop screen sharing here. Let me screen share on my iPad. And we'll go to, I think I was drawing. Yeah, this is what I do when I'm hanging out and I'm not drawing chemistry and I'm practicing my drawing skills and all my orchids that are hanging around. Okay, new. And what we want to do is to write out write the mechanism part of the discussion section for the acetylsalicylic acid experiment. So this is your assignment. The mechanism part of the discussion. That's what I want to do. So in that, let's take that mechanism and look at that mechanism again. Our mechanism started with acetic anhydride. And the first step of our reaction mechanism was the protonation of the acetic anhydride. And so the first thing that we would do is we would have this step. This would be figure one. And we would title this protonation of acetic anhydride. And then we would have our first paragraph of the reaction mechanism that's going to discuss what actually took place in this step. So we're going to break down each step and look at what is happening in each step. So here what we can say is something along the lines of the carbonyl. So again, it's not enough to say that it's protonated. We really want to describe where it's protonated as well, and then what that protonation is doing for us. So the carbonyl oxygen of acetic anhydride is protonated by phosphoric acid. The protonation results in an oxonium ion, with stabilized by resonance. You would go on to say here, and I'm just filling it out. What we would go on to say, and we could even include the resonance in another figure if we wanted to, is that this is activating the acetic anhydride for nucleophilic attack, and that by going through and protonating it, we're lowering the activation energy for the salicylic acid to then attack it and make a new oxygen carbon bond. And so the next figure that we would have, if we didn't do the resonance, the next figure that we would have is we would have the attack by the salicylic acid, just breaking each step down into a new figure with a caption, and then describing what actually took place. So this would be the second figure. You can add some color if you want, if it helps you in terms of tracking where everything is going. I know that when I went back and did that lecture, I put a lot of color into it. You can do it just in black and white if you're doing it in pencil. Both ways are acceptable. Okay, so this would be figure two. And this would be nucleophilic attack of salicylic acid. On acetic anhydride. And then I would get into the paragraph that would describe what is taking place here. The oxygen of the phenol is attacking the protonated carbonyl to form a new oxygen carbon bond. The carbonyl bond breaks, returning electrons onto the oxygen of the acetic anhydride. the attacking oxygen that was the phenol acquires the positive charge and forms a new complex and the new bond. And so we just want to find language to describe that. And you can go back and you can watch the video again, because it's all posted on there. The notes are all posted on there. The breakdown of all the things are posted on there. And you can go back and listen to the language that I used and go over each step and break it down and try to find your own wording to put it in there to describe what is actually taking place. That's the main key thing that I want you to do. So it's going to be, you know, going back to that video, hitting the pause button, watching each little section a little bit and doing some writing. And let's give you guys a week to do that, because I know you got other things to do too. So it's not due on Wednesday, but take a week to do it and we'll have it due next Monday. How's that sounding? You think I've given you enough information to kind of go through and do what you need to do?
Yes, thank you.
Cool. Sounds good, Colin. All right. I'm torn. I'm torn in that there's one more thing that I could do here that would be kind of interest, which is to show you the chemical literature and the tools that they have at UCSC and how to search the literature. Usually I wait and I do that during special projects, because you can actually go up and do it and you can go to UCSC and use the tools and I can demonstrate it. And this is such a great format to be able to demonstrate that in some of the tools that are available. But since you really can't use them and they're not appropriate for what we're doing right now anyway, I think I'm just going to bag on that. Maybe let's just cut it short today, take a longer break, and then we'll come back for lecture. And we'll just have an easy day today. How's that sound? Everybody good? Cool. Okay. Let's call it a day then. Unless there's any other questions that I can deal with, you guys want to throw some things out to me, I'm happy to stay on the line. And even if you just want to chat and say hello for a few minutes, I'll hang around. And other than that, let's call it a break and we'll see you back at 11:10.
So for the lab assignments, you're expecting us to turn in the first four lab reports, correct?
Yes. So we had those outlined before, and those were, well, the first one was almost nothing. I didn't really have you do anything for the first one. That was just the calibrations, the pipettes. So everybody just got full credit for that. The second one was the solubility. The solubility lab had a number of questions that were written up for the solubility, and I wanted to see the lab notes from the solubility reports. The third one was the crystallization one. That was the one where we did the mixed melting points unknowns, and you had a number of questions to answer from that one as well. And then the fourth one was the extraction one, and the extraction one had a number of questions to deal with, and I wanted to see the lab report notes from that one as well. Then we got into the chromatography, and in the middle of chromatography, we went into shelter in place. So that's where I stopped having you guys do the questions from the laboratory manual. We ditched it from there. So it would have been really the three. It would have been solubility, crystallization, and extraction. Those are the three that I'm looking for. And I have a lot of them. A lot of people already turned them in. And I went through and I converted everybody's work into PDFs and put them all into files for you so that I've got them on my computer, all safely stored and pulled out of my email and all in one place. And so if you turn those things in, I've got them. If you haven't turned those things in yet, turn them in at any point. And it's just a matter of going through and taking pictures of your laboratory notebook, converting those into PDFs if you can. If you can't, I'll deal with it. And answering the questions out of the back in Pavia, which was, there's two sections, a question section and a report section. They name them differently, but they are just a different set of questions for each thing. And you're just answering those questions. You can write them out by hand on paper in the laboratory notebook if you want, or on separate sheets of paper, however you want to do it. And they just all get turned in together. Does that answer it?
Yep.
Cool.
Well, thank you, Jason.
Hey, you're welcome, Jorge.
In like 40 minutes or something.
Yeah, 11:10. We'll see you later. Okay, everybody else good? We'll call it till 11:10, and I'm going to go get some breakfast because I didn't get breakfast yet this morning.
Thank you, Jason.
You're welcome. Thank you, guys.
Have a good one.
You too. We'll see you in a bit.